this to me is like the really fascinating material.
We don't know what the answer is, but we're looking for patterns.
I think we're looking at kind of a type of cosmic alchemy.
The story slowly grew into forgiveness.
But still, a lot of people don't know that this technology actually exists.
The possibilities here are pretty mind-boggling.
We can't just believe.
It's been a long time coming to get you on. Did you record?
Yeah, we're rolling.
We're rolling. Yeah. So like, I remember hearing you on World of the Unexplained back in the day.
Dear Lord, that has been forever.
Yeah. That was one of my favorite podcasts.
Yeah, it was, that was the, I think that might've been the first podcast I was on. They had me on quite a few times. It was a ball. I'm still in contact with the main guy.
Yeah, Jay Scott.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great dude. I went to for about 4 years ago and hung out with him in North Carolina.
He keeps inviting me to, and I just haven't made it there yet.
Yeah, one day we'll all have to get over there or something.
Yeah, I mean he's told me about all the great breweries where he lives. That's really, really pulling at me.
Yeah, we got a lot of them here in Nashville too, apparently, as I've been told. We got axe throwing rooms. We're about to have an axe throwing room.
Yeah, we
got inside information on that. Mm-hmm. Pretty, Rob's pretty excited about that.
Oh, I'm so excited.
And I wanted to point out that this is the first time all three of us have been here since episode 250.
Yes.
Is it really?
Yes. Because we didn't have Seraphiel for two episodes, and then the next two we didn't have you, and now here we are.
Well, you didn't miss any though.
I didn't miss any.
So that's what matters.
No. So we have already started. So welcome to Conspiranormal, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just, we'll get started just talking about kind of like your background, like what you got you interested in all this weird kind of stuff and like what some of your other books have been about.
Well, I was a weird kid. I've been interested in this for a long time. I was more interested in watching reruns of, you know, Lost in Space and Star Trek than I was watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhoods. So yeah, give me a good Godzilla movie anytime over Sesame Street too. I didn't pay too much attention to any of that. What got me into the paranormal to begin with, other than, you know, being the weird kid, was I saw a full bodied apparition in my house when I was about eight or 9 years old. Mm-hmm. I walked out of my bedroom and was walking into a hallway to pick up a book. It was probably an encyclopedia on dinosaurs or something. And there was a little boy in the hallway who definitely shouldn't have been there. And, you know, I could see everything about him. You know, blue flannel shirt, blue jeans, brown unkempt hair. And he was staring at me. And the weird thing I noticed, other than him trespassing, was the fact that I could see the bookshelf through him. And I just turned around and walked back into my bedroom and shut the door. I never saw that again, but that kind of got me in a paranormal frame of mind. I always wanted to figure out what that was I saw.
Was there any? What was the history of the house? Was there any kind of like hauntings in the house, or just was that just a one time thing?
Well, you know, I'd always heard things. The house, when I was a kid, was about 120 years old, which means now it's probably about, you know, 400. But it would have been a two-room country schoolhouse. It had two big classrooms. And when schools consolidated in my state, little country schools got closed down. And my grandparents, whom my grandmother taught in that school, had it turned into a three-bedroom house. And they didn't have any problems. Again, I heard things, I talked with my sisters when we were adults. They never heard anything. But I talked with people who moved in many years after I'd moved out, and they said, dude, this house is haunted. So I'm really not sure why. I don't think anybody ever died there, but who knows?
Right. Yeah. No, nobody did any kind of real, like, research on it to see. You just kind of assume a house that old that it's...
It's something to it. Well, you know, two things. One is that ghosts aren't fixed in any place, any one place. They can move wherever they want to. I don't know. Maybe this kid died and he just really liked school. Maybe that's why he hung around. Yeah. Or his body could be buried in the basement. Hell, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure that that's kind of comforting to think about, right? Not freaky at all.
Well, and I didn't, because people have asked me about this. You know, Jason, why didn't you research it? And I didn't want to know who the kid was.
Yeah.
I mean, it was way too personal for me, and I didn't want to know. I'd interviewed a psychic named Joyce Morgan. This was years before I'd had any of my paranormal books published. So she had no idea who I was when I cold called her, and we were just talking, and she said, oh, you saw a ghost when you were a child. And I'm like, oh yeah, I did. One, I've always thought psychics were just, they were bunk. I always thought it was complete bunk. But then this woman described exactly what I saw, and she was the one who brought it up. And she goes, I can tell you his name. And I'm like, nope, I don't want to know. Don't want to know at all. Hmm.
It's interesting your reaction to it as well, that you just kind of walked away and just went back in your room, and you didn't like run out of the house screaming, which right. I think is what a lot of people think would happen if you see a ghost.
And you know, you would think that. And I've interviewed so many people who've told me that they saw a shadow person or what they thought was a demonic entity or was a ghost in their room when they were laying in bed, and all they did was pull the covers over their head until they went to sleep. Just a vast amount of people do that. And that always, you know, struck me as odd in one way, but I kind of did that too when I walked into my bedroom and shut the door.
Hmm. Yeah. I've had that experience too, where you see something and you just fall back to bed, fall back asleep. Yeah. It's not what people would, the way people react to this is not the way people would think that we get from like popular culture.
Right. I mean, and this is also, if I can bring Bigfoot into this, of course, I'll go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because people are always, you know, your skeptics are always saying, well, you know, if there's so many Bigfoot out there and there's so many people see Bigfoot all the time, how come there aren't any good pictures of Bigfoot? And you know, I think of pulling the covers over my head or walking back in my room. I think a lot of people who encounter the unknown do that. They're like not thinking of capturing this for posterity's sake. They're thinking of, you know, getting out of there, getting away from this unknown thing that, you know, that they're encountering. And I just think that's completely normal, and it doesn't bother me a bit. Because if I were out in the woods and a 9 foot tall, stinking, hairy creature, you know, was 20 feet away, I mean, the last thing I would think of doing is pulling out my phone and taking a picture. You know, I'd be turning around and leaving.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that for sure. And, you know, since we're on the subject, I had written down, we talk a little bit about the Gimlin film. Do you got any thoughts on that? This is, of course, is the famous Bigfoot, the Patty, as they call it.
The Patterson-Gimlin film. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I sure do. I'm sorry, my four-year-old just came down here asking me a question.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah. Hey, honey, go upstairs. Thank you. She's not listening. All right, so this is going to be a fun interview. The Patterson-Gimlin film, I mean, I saw it when... when was the first time I saw it? It might have been on In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, which is something else I was fixated on. I loved that show. But at the time that this thing was shot, there are there's some problems with it. The main problem is that Patterson, Roger Patterson, said to his buddy Bob Gimlin, "I want to go take a movie of a Bigfoot." And he went out and rented a camera, and they took horses, and they went to this spot where Bigfoot had been allegedly seen before. And wow, lo and behold, they find one. And they happened to capture on this rented camera that I don't think Patterson ever returned. I think I heard Bob Gimlin say that once on an interview. But he had this camera that he probably – I don't know if he knew how to use it that well, but he sure got – it sure got a picture of something walking through this dry creek bed just casually, and it turns around and looks and then keeps going. Now, what are the chances of this guy, who was also kind of a trickster guy, you know, looking for the next big score? What's the, you know, this is my new scheme to get to make money. Now, what are the chances of him renting a camera, and this day he went up to Bluff Creek? What are the chances of him actually stumbling on a Bigfoot? But it happened. Now, putting that on one side, on the other side, good God, they couldn't have produced that. No, that I don't think could have been faked in, what was it, 67, 68? 67, I think. There's no way that could have been faked, for a number of reasons. One, the best makeup they had at that point, or costumes, was what they had in the 1968 Planet of the Apes film with Charlton Heston and Roddy McDowall. And, you know, they didn't look like apes, really, but they still looked pretty good.
Yeah, you just look like people dressed as apes. Yeah,
that had an ape head. That's what they looked like. But this was an entire body. You know, watching TV shows and you know, cheesy movies that had gorillas in them at that time, you know, the suits were terrible. This suit, one, it was really good. Two, or really well done. And two, you can see muscle definition. Muscles moving in the legs as it walks. That's not faked. And then, why would these two guys have picked a female Bigfoot to fake?
Yeah.
Yeah, that wouldn't, you know, if I were faking a Bigfoot, that would not occur to me whatsoever. It'd be a guy. So on one hand, it seems unlikely that these guys, you know, would be able to find a Bigfoot and get good footage of it. But also, on the other hand, man, I really think that's Bigfoot footage.
Yeah, those are the points that leave me really torn as far as the Patterson-Gimlin film. Because he did, prior to this, have a budget for a film involving something very similar. Like, had it all laid out and stuff. And then he happened to supposedly capture this natural footage, which it's so hard for me to believe, but the video itself, the points that you're making there, like, it's so hard. It would be so nearly impossible at that time to produce something like that as well. So I'm going to be on the fence with this one for probably the rest of my life, but
yeah. But well, just think about, you know, it's
the creatures, the gait of the creature and the way, the way it moves over the obstacles and stuff on the ground that sell me most on this being authentic, I think.
Right. I mean, people don't walk like that thing was walking.
Right.
The way it moved its eggs, their legs, and the arms,
the bone structure it would have and stuff like that is.
Yeah, very gorilla-like man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the movies, they were still, Ray Harryhausen was still doing stop motion animation on monsters. You know, that's where the movie industry was at that point.
Mm-hmm. There was a guy in North Carolina that said that was the suit that he made at that time. But like, there's just no way.
Well, and there's a guy that claims to be the person in the suit too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And people can say anything. These people are looking for attention. And, you know, Bob Gimlin still gets attention. He's late 80s, early 90s, and he's still going to conventions and talking, telling his story. But you really don't make money doing that. I mean, did he ever really try to produce anything to make money off of, you know, being one of two guys who photographed Bigfoot? I don't think so.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a good point.
So why a book about American monsters? Why this encyclopedia kind of format going through the all 50 states?
Well, I had growing up, I'm from Missouri. In fact, I still live here, a different part of the state, but still in the same state. You know, I hate all the paperwork with, you know, changing your license plate and all that stuff. So probably stuck here for a while. But when I was a kid, in our local metropolitan newspaper, Kansas City, Missouri, their paper was the Kansas City Times. And even as a kid, as soon as I learned to read, I devoured anything. And I started reading the newspaper because my parents did. And they had stories about a creature, a tall, hairy creature in Louisiana, Missouri. And there were eyewitness stories. There were footprints they made plaster casts out of. There were hunting parties going out after it. It terrorized some teenage girls. It killed a dog. And, you know, all this other stuff. And it was a Bigfoot in my home state. And I'm like, wow, this is the greatest thing ever. So I would disappear out in the cornfields for hours and tick my mom off pretty good. But I was looking for Bigfoot. So I've been interested in monsters for quite a while. And, you know, I've researched other monsters in my home state and have known of monsters in other states. And I just thought, you know, there's got to be more to Washington State than Sasquatch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there, you know, there's got to be more, you know, to Hawaii than the Minnehuhi, you know, and, you know, various, there's, you know, more to Florida than just Florida man. So I started looking and there were some really cool monsters I had never heard of before in other states. So I put a compendium together and I've written a couple of regional books, and a lot of people have written regional books, which are fine. They're cool books to read. But, you know, if I'm, you know, living in Kansas or Utah, you know, I don't want to pick up a book about Missouri and read about their monsters. But, you know, hey, look at this. Hey, this got Utah monsters. It's got Idaho monsters, Montana, you know, all the, you know, surrounding states. So, yeah, I just thought it would be just be nice to put all that in one book.
Yeah, absolutely. And the monster you're talking about, is that the Momo?
Yeah, Momo, the Missouri monster.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had a couple of, let's just start like in your state, your home state.
Okay.
So we talked about the Momo.
Well, can I throw something else about Momo first?
Yeah.
It is one type of Bigfoot. See, this is the thing about Bigfoot. There are so many different varieties just in the United States alone.
Yes.
You know, we've got the Harry and the Hendersons looking Bigfoot from the Pacific Northwest. We've got one that looks like an orangutan, the Micalac skunk ape down in Florida. There are other ones that look like, you know, tall, skinny chimps. And then we've got creatures like Momo, the folk monster, which is what the Legend of Boggy Creek was based on. And we've got the Honey Island Swamp Monster down in Louisiana. Those last three I mentioned have three-toed footprints.
Well, so I was going to say the three-toed. I think Texas, too, has like – they're more aggressive.
Well, that's because they're Texans.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, but there are so many different – and then we don't just have – I mentioned the Harry and the Hendersons variety, which has got an ape-like face. We've also got a lot of reports of Sasquatch with a human face. It looks more human than it does ape. Mm-hmm. And you know, Native Americans have always said that – you know, these big hairy men are just another tribe of humans. And
Most older reports are that way too. If you go back 100 or 200 years ago, it was mostly wild men type of reports. Like they were hairy, but they were very human in the face.
Yeah, Tim Renner writes a lot about that. Does he? Yeah.
Yeah, and one thing that's you know got me curious. I've been thinking actually quite a bit about it the last couple of months. We've got those reports. We've got I can't remember the guy's name. I think he was a prospector in British Columbia and was kidnapped by a Bigfoot, you know, back in the 30s. Cannot remember the guy's name, but he was certain he was taken back to the family of Bigfoot, and he was pretty sure that he was, you know, supposed to mate this Sasquatch who stole him's daughter. Mm-hmm. Why would that have happened if it wouldn't have worked? We've got Dr. Melba Ketchum, who's her Sasquatch project. She's had samples from a Bigfoot, you know, like hair and other things that she's had DNA analysis done on, and the analysis shows that whatever this came from was human, although there were a couple of anomalies in the DNA sequence. A researcher in Alberta. Same thing. He had some Sasquatch hair and had it analyzed, and it came back as being human, but with some anomalies. A researcher in England, a college professor, you know, had the same thing. A Russian, an Alma, he had some hair from, and it came back as human with some anomalies. So people will say, okay, then it was just contaminated, or you know, it's coming from people. Yeah, I'm wondering if that really was Bigfoot hair, Bigfoot scat, Bigfoot blood, and they're just human enough to where the DNA comes out, you know, as human.
I think it's entirely possible. I've said this before, that there could be some kind of subspecies of human that just managed to, maybe like the Neanderthal, maybe there's a remnant that survived somehow. I think that's entirely possible to have happened. I don't think that's without the realm of reason, you know.
And I agree. I agree. I'm more leaning on that side than I am Bigfoot being an ape, mainly because of the feet. It's got human feet. Why would it have human feet if it's an ape?
Well, when you get to the three-toed stuff, though, that's getting a little weirder.
Right. Yeah. Right. It sure is. Well, but again, I mean, there are. How many humans look different? You know, if you take, a short woman and a really tall, hairy man, and you know, show them to somebody who's, you know, to an alien that's never seen humans before, would they think that they were the same species? I don't know. You know, so that much we got a lot of variation in humans. So, you know, why not in Sasquatch?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if Sasquatch exists, then if they're spread out in like kind of like these populations that are isolated from each other, then that's entirely possible. But then you got to ask yourself, what are we actually dealing with? The whole physical and spiritual Bigfoot, you know, the interdimensional Bigfoot. That's some. Then stuff gets really weird.
Right. And here's how I am on that. I know that is the popular thing right now, is the interdimensional Bigfoot, or the extraterrestrial Bigfoot. And there are a lot of things about Bigfoot that don't logically add up. Like, how can it just something that big just disappear? And I view on that. I spent a lot of time in the woods growing up. And there were many times to where a deer would be within a couple of feet of me, and I would not have noticed if it hadn't, you know, gotten scared and ran away. Mm-hmm. You know, these things are used to being in the woods, you know, them being able to vanish, you know, might be not, I don't mean literally vanish, but just blend in with their surroundings. You know, that just might be natural. And I also don't like, I'm this way with UFOs as well. I'm a nuts and bolts guy. And with Bigfoot, at least right now, I'm a flesh and blood guy, because I would like those, if they're not, I would like for those theories to be scientifically discounted before we move on to something like interdimensional.
Right. See, and you're touching on something I think is pretty important to bring up, and that's that a lot of these theories are ways to dodge the how is there a breeding population question. Instead of answering that question, there's a lot of people leap to a lot more out there theories instead.
Right, and with those out there theories are unknown, but Bigfoot's unknown, so we're answering an unknown by giving another right. unknown.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point. Yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't add up. So I'm not saying that Bigfoot can't be like an interdimensional creature, but I want to disprove the flesh and blood before I move on to something like that.
Yeah, I can hear the I hear you on that. I think more than likely, it could be more likely for Bigfoot to be a real thing than UFOs being something tangible. I can definitely see that.
Well, with Bigfoot, thinking about all of the monsters I've read about and I've written about and I've interviewed people who've seen, and I think my bet would have to be on Bigfoot as to, which one might actually be real. I'm not saying it is, but I'm saying I'd put my money on that.
Sure.
How do you get behind, like, have you looked into, like, just as far as numbers and statistics go for breeding populations throughout, like, just say North America, as far as food sources, what lifespans would have to be, how many there would have to be to keep, like, bloodlines from getting mixed up, that sort of thing? Have you researched that at all?
Well, I've read some on it. I've heard is upwards of 20,000 as a breeding population to really secure the bloodline and that. Actually, at one point, I read a paper by, this has been a number of years ago, by an anthropologist who said during the last ice age, he speculated the human population was down to 2,000.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if we could come back from that, if there could be 20,000 Bigfoot in North America, I'd say that's plenty. And when it comes to food, it depends on what they're eating. Are they strictly herbivores? Are they omnivores? I'm more leaning toward that because there's been a lot of reports of them chasing down deer, or there was one hilarious video of a Bigfoot picking up a pig and tripping over something and dropping it. I don't know if you saw that one or not.
I haven't seen this. No, I haven't heard of this.
But I also read a guy who studied, again, I'm bad on names right now. A guy who was studying Bigfoot sightings in a certain area around it was the California area, and in relation to the rabbit population. And when it showed that the rabbits would move, but move around, and they would the populations would get smaller and larger, and when the rabbit population was getting smaller, the Bigfoot Bigfoot sightings would decrease, and then Bigfoot sightings would increase where the populations were getting larger. So he had speculated that, Bigfoot are, migratory. And when their, meat source was thinning out, they moved to some place where it was bigger and made a big loop and came back when the rabbits had repopulated.
I've seen other reports like that. I don't have any sources to cite for this at all, but where sightings seem to be more dense near water sources, and seasonally sightings tend to be more dense in warmer times in the north and then in the south, where climate changes. And maybe it's just because people are more out in the wilderness during those times. But there could be a lot of other elements to that as well. But it's just interesting that you would get these clusters of sightings at different times and in different areas and under different conditions.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That was just wrapping that up. If it's actually something that is out there that people are seeing, it's interesting that it does fluctuate with varying conditions and stuff.
Well, and that's what, I mean, animals migrate, you know, whenever, you know, their food sources get slim. You know, we've got birds and you know, butterflies, eels, you know, so many different types of animals that migrate to warmer climates and a better food source, and then come back when it changes. And, you know, as hunter gatherers, we did the same thing. We would go to an area and kill and eat, and then when the food sources were running low, we'd move someplace else, or whenever the weather changed, we'd move to where it was nicer weather, where more animals were. So, you know, why wouldn't Bigfoot?
Right. Another, well, did you have something, Sir Phil?
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I wonder how many rabbits an adult Bigfoot can put down.
Yeah, I know. I'd say, you know, 800 800 pound creature could probably put down quite a few. Well,
I was at the Expedition Bigfoot Museum in Blue Ridge, Georgia on Saturday, and they had a Bigfoot, a Bigfoot turd. So if that's any indication.
How big was it?
It was rather long.
Rather long. Well, the average human colon is 6 feet, and Bigfoot's got to be a lot bigger than
right,
that.
Yeah.
Bigfoot can really pack it in there. So staying in Missouri just for a little bit, he had an interesting story that was only like a paragraph long, but just equally fascinating, was the space penguins.
Well, and you know, it's penguins are adorable. And, you know, yeah.
Very true.
This was terrific. Man, I love this story. This is one that I'd never heard of until I started researching Missouri. And I'm like, whoa, green penguins. A farmer named Claude Edwards, in 1967, it was Valentine's Day. He was just out walking his around his farm, and he noticed a really tall green metallic mushroom sitting in a field. And, oh, yep, you know, I'm going to check that out. So he goes, and he sees that he's not sure what it is except for a green metallic mushroom. And there are 3-foot-tall green waddling what looked like penguins. And they had large black eyes. And, you know, I'm really not too sure what I'd do in that situation. I'd probably back away if they hadn't seen me. You know, definitely get out of there. But he did something a little bit tougher, a little bit ballsier. He picked up rocks and threw it at them. And the rocks hit, like a force field and bounced off. And this got the penguins' attention. You don't want to tick penguins off. But anyway, he got the penguins' attention, and all they did was went inside the big giant mushroom. Giant mushroom took off in the air and floated away. This one, and this wasn't until after the book was published, and I was going over it again. I was really wondering about the description of the penguins. And although I was making a joke about them being cuddly, they are cuddly and lovable looking. But it reminded me of, you know, extraterrestrial encounters, gray encounters, because people have reported seeing deer, which are also beautiful creatures, yeah, with great big almond-shaped black eyes. And people have reported seeing giant rabbits with black eyes, or big owls with, yep, black eyes. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, to mentally mask the fact that these are aliens that they're having the encounter with. And I'm wondering if that wasn't the same with the penguins. You know, they were, maybe disguising themselves telepathically as something that didn't look aggressive.
Yeah, possibly so. It really sounds like one of those high strangeness episodes that you hear a lot about in UFO lore too. The right, high strangeness factor. The other story that I found interesting from Missouri, this is very strange, was the night people.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite ones in the book, just because it's weird. And it happened in my hometown, so that's even a bonus for me. A guy from Orrick, Missouri, named Vern Windsor, when he was small, around 6 years old, he'd be told to go to bed. and he didn't want to go to sleep. So he went in his room and he played, and he started noticing that there was activity outside his window, and he would look and just watch. And there were people outside his house, and they'd be walking in and out of neighborhood homes, mowing the lawn. Kids would be playing. There would be like a young couple pushing a stroller with a baby down the sidewalk, and everything looked normal except they had big fish eyes, big bulbous eyes like a fish. And that didn't really bother him because they were out at night, and he called these people the night people. Because they were doing all these things outside, like, again, chatting over the, over the fence to the neighbor, and, you know, mowing yards. He just figured that these people were the people who lived in the houses and did things at night. And the people he knew, like his family, were the day people. Uh-huh. To a 6-year-old mind, that makes sense. And he watched them. And, one night, one of the night people noticed that he was looking at them, and he'd seen the kids out there playing, and he wanted to go play. And when the adult night person noticed that Vern was watching him, he just blacked out, and he woke up the next morning lying on the floor, and he had a bloody nose. So this also kind of drips of alien encounters as well.
Very H.P. Lovecraft.
A bit. Hey, I'm actually wearing a t-shirt that says Miskatonic University.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's like almost like he's seeing into some kind of other dimension almost. It's like what it kind of seems to me. But, I mean, that's bizarre.
There
story.
Are a lot of different explanations you can make out of this, and who knows? Who knows what it could be? It's simply a bizarre story.
Have you had any other similar stories that you've come across?
No, not. But his, I mean, he said a couple of years later they'd moved to a nearby town, and he saw them occasionally.
Really?
Yeah, but that was it. They he didn't see them very much after that.
So weird. So we'll go to Arizona here, where one of our guys is from. Serfiel here is from Arizona.
Yes, sir.
He had a couple that were interesting, but the dragons are like pterosaur kind of like creatures that people would see. And this is actually something that people see all over the country, apparently.
Well, all over the world, yeah. Frankly, yes. I used the heading of dragon because then that's what it was called back in 1890 when people saw this. There were some cowboys who rode into Tombstone, Arizona, in 1890 with a lizard skin, and they claimed it was a giant flying lizard that they'd killed outside of town. They'd chased it and just shot and killed it. They shot at it and eventually it died. They said it was a dragon, and it measured, it was 92 feet long, and it had 80 foot wingspans. The head was 8 foot long and pointed. They said the eyes were the size of dinner plates, and that's an enormous creature.
Yeah. That's crazy big.
Yeah. There were, I'm trying to remember the size of these. There were pterodactyls, I think, had up to 20 to 30 foot wingspan. One of the varieties, I mean, there were varieties that different types that had wingspans of, 10 inches long. And there were some that were almost, I think, like I said, about 30 feet long. And that's pretty enormous, but not nearly as big as what they claimed to have shot in Tombstone.
Jeez.
But as I said, these things have been seen all over the place. There was a case in Texas in 1977. Three teachers were driving home from an educational conference, and there was a shadow that flew over the car, and they pulled over and looked up, and they saw, what looked like a pterodactyl flying over their car, and it just glided and off into the distance. And I really like this one because teachers in 1977. I think teachers would know what a pterodactyl looked like, you know, and they didn't make enough money to buy Coke. So I'm sure that what they saw was right. And these things are seen all over Mexico, New Guinea. I interviewed a University of Missouri professor. This has been a number of years ago, but he goes to Africa, where they have the legend of the Kogamatu, which is described as a large flying lizard. It has wings like a bat, a tail that ends in a diamond shape. On the way, the hands, claws are on the wings, and it's got a head that with a crest and a long pointed beak. And in one of this professor's trips, he took a book with a picture of dinosaurs, and they all, you know, the tribesmen pointed out Kogamatu, you know, to the picture of the pterodactyl. So this all also leads to another question: how the hell could they have survived the you know, massive extinction in 65 million years ago? And there are a lot of species that survived. Our world's a big one, and I think that these things very well could have lived through that.
Well, and those were the same creatures that evolved into birds anyway and survived. Right. So I don't think it's that big of a stretch as far as survival goes. How do you feel about a lot of people lump those kind of sightings in with the Native American Thunderbird stuff? Do you think those are two separate kind of incidents?
Yeah, I certainly do. I certainly do. I think the Thunderbirds are more like Teratorns. Teratorns are the largest birds in North America that died out during the last ice age, the, you know, Pliocene and Pleistocene eras. And they were basically enormous condors.
Right.
And they had about 20 to 25 foot wingspan. And they were, you know, of course, I mean, big enough to, you know, to pick up large animals and take them off and eat. And they're called Thunderbirds because when they took off, their wing beats sounded like thunder. There have been a lot of sightings of those too. I think it was in Pennsylvania, a 12-year-old boy was picked up by one.
Yeah.
And he screamed and thrashed enough it dropped him. And there's not many years ago, just a few, there was a pilot flying a small airplane in Alaska and saw a bird that was the same size as his airplane flying next to him that eventually, you know, glided off in another direction. So, I mean, they're modern day sightings. Who says these things can't be around either?
Yeah, there's also the Van Meter Visitor, which kind of resembled a pterodactyl-like creature.
Yes. Yeah. It sure did. Except for I think that's the one that had a spotlight in its head.
Yeah. It also had some kind of weird sigil on its chest.
Like, I've never heard about weird... this.
Yeah. This is the Van Meter monster from Van Meter, Iowa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, it was terrorizing the town, and people were terrified of it. And it was mentioned in newspapers that the local banker, pastor, and a doctor saw it. So, you know, that all made, you know, made it be real. There was a businessman who shot at it. There was a lawman who shot at it and hit it. And its skin was thick enough that the bullets didn't really do anything. So a bunch of people from town got the heaviest guns they could find and chased it. And it disappeared into a dead mine, and eventually it came out again along with a second one, and they shot at both of them enough to where they retreated back into the mine, and nobody ever saw them again.
We got to talk about, because this is in the Arizona section too, but there's other places. I think Missouri, you have an entry on this, is the giant human skeletons that were found. In the Indian mounds, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's not I did talk about it in Arizona, but yes, in Missouri also. There were also Pennsylvania and New York, these things were found. We're giant human skeletons, 8-9 feet tall, 6 fingers, 6 toes, 2, you know, double rows of teeth in their mouth, and ones that were found in Arizona still had hair, and the hair was long and red. And this corresponds with Native American legends of these red-haired, white-skinned cannibalistic giants that would prey upon the tribes and eat the children and whoever they could capture. These stories are widespread, and supposedly there are some skeletons down in Central America in museums, which I find fascinating. If it actually is real, I don't know. But I mean, we have had stories of giants forever.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, not just the stories here. There's stories on islands, out in the Pacific. There's, stories in, Ireland, England, all across Europe. And of course we've got the biblical giants. And, all I learned in Sunday school about giants is there was one, and his name was Goliath. But then reading more about it, there were entire villages of these things.
Yeah, the Nephilim. They talk about that one. It was like the Israelites are getting to finally get into the Promised Land, and they send the two spies in there, and they see that there's these big guys, the big giants, and they're all scared to go in. And two of the spies say, "Well, we can take them. You know, they're not that big and bad." But they were scared about it. So you have that written in there. It's like I don't know. I mean, I'm conflicted on that because maybe there could have been just like really unusually tall people, and maybe some of those accounts are exaggerated, possibly.
Well, and when it comes to history, I mean, things are exaggerated. I mean, look at the skin of the dragon in Arizona. That sounds extremely exaggerated.
Right, right.
Yeah, but back to church. You know, we only got the one giant. I never wanted to go to Sunday school. My kids don't want to go to Sunday school. But if they would have, had better PR, the church, you know what? They could call Sunday school, dragon slaying, blood gushing story time. Yeah, I would love to have gone to that.
Because why not? I mean, you got the Philistines in there. You got guys like, toppling pillars and on all kinds on stuff. And,
you've got nuclear bombs dropping on Sodom and Gomorrah. There's death everywhere.
That's right. Yeah, the Bible's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So let's go to Michigan.
Yeah.
Mr. Rob's home state. And let's talk about I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but the Nain Rouge.
Nain Rouge. You know about
this, Rob? I've never heard of this.
This is an old Native American legend. The Nain Rouge was they didn't call it that. That's the French name. It was a dwarf, a red dwarf.
Oh, I have heard of this. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that would that they viewed as a protector. And when the French founded Detroit, the French guy is Antoine de la Mothe Cadillac. Settled the area in 1701. He saw the creature, and it had red eyes, rotten teeth, reddish black fur all over its body. The skin was red, and it didn't kill him, but it attacked him. And the French that were in the area referred to it as a symbol of death. When the French fought the English at the Battle of Bloody Run in 1763, 58 British soldiers were killed. It was so bloody that legend has it the creek ran, nearby creek ran red for a couple of days afterward. But the Nain Rouge was seen after that point as being an because it was dancing among the dead bodies, and it was seen as a foreteller of something evil happening. It was seen during the War of 1812. When people saw it in the 1900s, it was, it brought some kind of death. There was a 12th Street riot in 1967. The red dwarf was seen by a number of people before that. In 1976, utility workers thought they saw a child climbing up a utility pole, and then they saw that it was a red dwarf, and there was a huge ice storm that hit right afterward. It hasn't been seen for years, but they have a parade in Detroit and a beer called Detroit Dwarf Lager that's dedicated to the Nain Rouge.
Yeah, there was another story that I heard. I don't remember exactly how it plays out, but there's something about this guy who had never heard of this thing was warned to you know, whatever you do, don't insult the red dwarf or the Nain Rouge. And he ends up at this some social gathering and runs into this creature, and it's like hideous, and he's like treats it like crap or whatever, and it, you know, his life ends up being destroyed and whatever. He finds financial ruin and his love leaves him, or however the story plays out, but it's something, it was more prophetic in that story.
Well, and there's something else that I kind of ran into when I was researching this book. Don't mess with little people. There are stories all over the world of people between 2 and 3 feet tall that will, you know, that are more powerful than humans and will bring a lot of misery.
Yeah, this story was very reminiscent of like Celtic lore.
Right. Yeah, we've got all throughout Europe, we've got, you know, goblins, kobolds, trolls, dwarfs, boabecks, I think it's another nerd term for goblin. In we've got elves in England and Iceland. We've got the tomtar in Sweden. And these things will steal children, replace it with, you know, a changeling. If you're rude to it, it will cause all sorts of mischief and damage to your life. And the same stories are over here in North America as well. We've got on the East Coast, the Puckwudgie.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing to me about the Puckwudgie, and there's the little people of Spirit Mound in South Dakota, and also similar stories in Utah of these 2 to 3 feet tall human type creatures that can turn invisible. They shoot poison arrows. They can start fires. They will be mischievous if you're nice to them, or if you're, you know, mean to them or rude to them, they will lead you through the woods and, you know, tease you off a cliff or just outright shoot you with a poison arrow. And the stories are the same. That's what blows me away. These stories are the same all across North America. How is that possible?
Yeah, exactly. That's it's amazing to me just how similar all these stories are, and just people have they see these little people, and yeah, you're right. There's also the Michigan Mermen.
I haven't heard of that one either.
Yeah,
right. And I'm not going to be able to pronounce the Native American names. There are a whole lot of vowels and consonants that I'm not going to tackle. But this was around Lake Superior. These creatures resembled children that had hair covered faces and were also part fish. When French Canadian trappers and fishermen who were coming through the area, they were warned by the local Native Americans not to have any sort of contact with them. But they did. There was a French Canadian named Saint Germain. He wasn't a saint. That was his last name, Saint-Germain. And he was camped on an island, and he saw a creature in the lake that looked like a child. He was about 8 years old, and the kid had a dark complexion and a lot of curly hair, and the lower part looked like a fish. And Saint Germain tried to shoot it, and his local Native American guides were like, "No, you don't want to do that." But later that night, a storm struck the island, and it didn't dissipate for 3 days. And the Indians were blaming Saint Germain because he tried to kill it.
It was funny. I'd never heard of this, so I Googled it. And there's like dozens and dozens of mermaid in Lake Michigan videos that popped up, like drone footage and all kinds of craziness.
See, and this bothers me so much is I would love to be able to trust photography, but I can't. Oh, yeah,
totally. But just the fact that there's like a whole bunch of people faking this. I never even heard of this being a thing.
Well, one you have probably heard of is the Dog Man.
I have definitely heard of the Dog Man. I grew up with, they play the song every Halloween.
The song?
Oh, there's a Dog Man song. Yeah. It's not great, but.
I'll have to look that up. How's it go, Rob?
I don't remember. I just remember being a kid and like every Halloween it would come on. My dad would be like, oh yeah, this is real. Listen to the song.
So has the Dog Man been a thing there for a while? Because I only remember really hearing about it, like the Beast of Bray Road stuff.
Oh, well, it all dates back to, I think, probably the 70s in Wisconsin and Michigan.
Yeah.
Well, when it comes to the Dog Man, the first report was in the late 1800s. I think it was 1887. And a couple of lumberjacks reported to the local authorities and talked to the newspaper about seeing a dog that was walking on its hind legs. A lot of sightings were in the early 1900s. In 1928 in Paris, Michigan, a young man named Robert Fortney was charged by a pack of wild dogs. He fortunately had his gun with him, and he shot over their head to spook them, and he did. But there was one black dog that had blue eyes that didn't move. And it just stared him down. And Fortney shot again over the dog's head. And the monster, looking really ticked off, stood up on its back, his hind legs. And while he stared Fortney down, it turned to its side and walked into the woods. Mm. There were reports in the 50s, 70s, all the way up to the 2000s. Now, with the Beast of Bray Road in Wisconsin, I think those didn't start up until the 70s or maybe early 80s. But, yeah, Linda Godfrey's had done a whole lot of research on that.
So what do you think about the Dog Man? Do you think this is the real thing? Because it seems like it's been a real popular thing lately.
Yeah, and, you know, we get those with various cryptids or just entities. It's the big thing now. And when it comes to Dog Man, and, you know, I've read about a lot of cryptids, and when I think of a dog, you know, with humanish legs walking around, it seems, you know, pretty silly. But a friend of mine, I've known him for years, and he's really serious about the paranormal, and he has never yanked my chain about anything. He told me of a dogman encounter in central Missouri. He and a friend like to go to this cemetery out in the middle of nowhere near a small town named Brunswick. And on a rural highway, there's a dirt road, not even gravel, it's dirt, that goes off the highway, down a hill, up a hill, down another hill, and then up a hill to the cemetery. And I've been to the cemetery, and it's really creepy because it's got a big wooden cross that somebody had set on fire at one point. So it's very inviting.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, absolutely.
And this guy and his friends have, you know, investigated the cemetery a lot, and they started drawing maps every time they went, and the maps were never the same from time to time. It's like the tombstones and trees were in different places each time they went. And one night, he and one of his friends went, and nothing was happening at the cemetery, so they decided to leave early. It was about 10, 11 o'clock, and it was in the summer, so they had their windows of the pickup rolled down. And they went down a hill and up a hill and down the other one. And now this road went through woods, and there was, you know, a canopy. It was like you were driving through a tunnel because the trees joined over the road. And they got down to the bottom of this, the second hill, and there was a big dog. It looked like it was eating something in the middle of the dirt road. And they stopped about 20 feet from it, and they could smell wet dog coming through the open windows. And finally, my buddy's friend honked the horn, and the dog looked up, and it had yellow glowing eyes, and it stood up on its hind legs and stared at them as it walked on its hind legs into the woods and disappeared. And they rolled up their windows and locked their doors and got the hell out of there. But the point being is I know that guy, and I know he wasn't lying to me.
Wow. Wow.
Tennessee, where we are.
Okay.
Some interesting things.
What about it? All right. I just think it's funny about Tennessee that the Jack Daniel's distillery, it's in a dry county.
Yep. Yeah,
it is. That is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's hilarious. Well, I mean, it's got its Bigfoot stories. There's a Tennessee Wild Man. The Flintville Monster was another Bigfoot. I think this is a one source story, but it was cool enough that I put it in the book. It was called The White Screamer.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that one. This was in the 1920s near White Bluff, Tennessee. A man built a farm out in the country, and he and his family of nine were living there. And after they'd moved in, they started hearing this scream, this shriek, you know, out in the woods. And it would, of course, wake them up. It was so loud. It was like the scream of a banshee. And one night, the husband father, he just couldn't take it anymore. So he grabbed his shotgun and left. And he followed the sound. And the shriek led him into the woods, and it led him deeper into the woods, and it led him deeper. And it's, you know, he was following this kind of crazy path. And all of a sudden, he realized he was back at his farm. And the screams had changed just a little bit, and they were now coming from the house. And he ran toward the house, and when he got inside, the screams had stopped. The last screams were the screams of his family, and his entire family was bloody and butchered inside his home.
What was the source you got this from?
It was from an old newspaper article. I don't remember which one, frankly.
And where was this in Tennessee?
White Bluff.
White Bluff. Okay. Huh. That's one I had never heard that story at all. And I grew up in Tennessee, so wow. But that's not too far from here, no, it's actually. Not. Yeah. From where we are. Close to Dixon. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like something I'd want to go hang out and find.
Don't want to find the white screamer.
The white screamer, no.
But it has a lot of links to the Banshee folklore too.
Yeah,
it does, and this is something else that I really noticed about while I was researching this. When we have people moving from one area to another, I mean, mass migration from Europe to here, people brought their monsters with them,
right?
They just didn't pack the family heirlooms and, you know, enough food for the trip. They brought their monsters. There's a banshee story in South Dakota, and this sounds exactly like an Irish banshee. There are stories of Tommy knockers, which are the legend comes from Cornwall, England. There are miners that are supposedly all the Jews that were involved in killing Jesus involved in that. Their spirits were punished by being sent to England and banished in a mine, which doesn't make any sense. But anyway, that's the legend. But the Tommyknockers, when Cornish miners were hired in Pennsylvania and California, they brought the Tommyknockers with them, the stories of them. Same with werewolves and vampires. You know, they came over from Europe as well. So did they really come over, or was it just them talking, the people talking about these stories that made them come alive. I've wondered about this a lot because it seems to me that certain monsters or certain entities nobody's ever heard of before, but all of a sudden people start talking about it and the thing appears.
Well, Slender Man, I think, is a perfect case.
Yeah.
It is a perfect case. Yep. That was the first one I was going to bring up because people have, I've read stories and heard them on, you know, call into like Coast to Coast and places like that and swear to God that they've encountered the Slender Man. There's the same with Black Eyed Kids. Brian Bethel is a journalist. He still works in Texas. I interviewed him once. I still have contact with him, but he's the first guy to write about Black Eyed Kids. And it was like in 1998, he posted it on a message board on the internet of an encounter that he had. And I mean, I've gotten hundreds of Black Eyed Kids stories from around the world. You know, are we, just because we're putting so much energy in thinking about these entities, are we, you know, turning them into tulpas?
Manifest. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Right. Did you write a book about the Black Eyed Kids at a certain point?
No, I did not. I wrote a book on shadow people. And I was prepared. I had an outline written for a book on Black Eyed Kids, and it was going to be the first one out there. And my wife said, "You know what, Jason? None of the stuff you write about scares me, but they do. Black Eyed Kids do. So if you write a book and one of those things comes to my door, it's your ass, mister."
Yeah, this stuff is pretty freaky, man. I mean, it's.
I know.
I, you know, some of it, I just wonder, like, is somebody just making this story up or just, you know, because you always got to keep that in mind, too, with some of this stuff. But then there's others that I hear where I'm just like, man, that's just, it's just so weird.
Belief is a powerful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Black Eyed Kids story?
Man, I've got a lot of them. I do. I talked with a guy. He didn't want me to use his real name, so I didn't. I think I called him Brian in the story. I don't remember what his real name is, but he was living in he lives in Pennsylvania, and he was visiting a buddy in Pittsburgh. And there was a drive-in garage, a leveled garage next to his friend's apartment building. So he went and he couldn't find a decent place to park. So he parked on the top and there was a walkway over to his friend's apartment. So he just took that. And it was about 1 o'clock in the morning when he was like, you know, I really should be getting home. So he went and got in his car. And as he was walking to his car, there were a few lights on up on top. And he saw a couple of kids in their teens, in their mid to early teens, walking toward him. And he said that it really struck me as weird that they were up here, but it struck me even weirder that they were wearing hats and starter jackets, if you remember those.
Oh yeah.
From a team that didn't exist any, it hasn't existed, you know, since like the 80s or whatever. And
what in the world, man?
And they looked brand new.
What? It's retro, man. Retro.
Brand new. And so he got in his car because he got nervous, you know, undoubtedly, and he locked the door. Yeah. And he started the car and, you know, knock, knock, knock on his window. And he looked over and there was one of the kids standing in front of his window. And he rolled it down just a bit. And the second kid, who was a little smaller, was standing a few feet back. Well, so he was talking to this first kid who might have been 16. And the kid was like, "Would you please be kind enough to give us a ride home? We seem to be out too late." I mean, this is one of the things with Black Eyed Kids is that they talk way more mature than they should.
Right, right, yeah.
So this guy was talking, and the guy I talked to said that he just felt scared. And it wasn't that these kids came out of nowhere. That was part of it, but it was sort of an unnatural type of fear.
It's almost identical to Steve Stockton's story that he shared with us.
Yeah, yeah, he had a very similar story.
And he had reached, he even felt himself reaching to open this, to unlock the door. He was feeling compelled to do that. And all of a sudden he was like, what the hell am I doing? And he looked over and the other kid was around the back of the car. And he said it was like, you know, the velociraptors in Jurassic Park, when the Australian hunter. Yeah. Clever girl. Yeah. It was like they were animals trying to, you know, he was their prey. He felt like, yeah. And you know, he snatched his hand back and he looked at the kid. He got a really good look at the 16-year-old, and the kid's eyes were just black. No whites, no iris, nothing, just black.
Well, and what better form to take to prey on our
sympathy.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
What did a kid?
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I've had a few cases where the kids have been like 6-7 years old. A 6-7-year-old girl shows up on your doorstep and says, "I'm lost. Would you let me in?" Well, that means your initial reaction is to help the kid. But anyway, this guy popped it in reverse. The kid jumped from, you know, the back of the car, so he didn't run over him, and he took off, winding down this parking garage, scared to death that these kids would be waiting for him down there, but they weren't. So he got out of there, and he drove to the next stoplight, and it was red, so he stopped, and he was trying to catch his breath, and he looked over to the right, and on the corner, there were these two kids. So he ran the light and ran the next few lights he could run until he got to the highway and just sped home. He was terrified that he was going to see these things again, but he didn't that night.
It's like there's some kind of predator or something, and they're very much like vampires. It's all the vampire lore kind of stuff, just repackaged. You know
the scariest part of all this is that I've never heard a story where somebody helps the kids. Not once. Not once have I heard a story where someone lets them in the car.
Yeah.
You know why? Well, those people don't exist anymore. That's why.
There actually is a story where one was in the car, invited in by the kid. And have you heard this one, Jason? I think Weatherly talked about this in his book.
See, he's the guy who wrote the book. And I am so happy David Weatherly did, because I wasn't giving myself pressure to do it and piss my wife off.
Well, okay, so they're at a gas station, and this the mother runs in to get something, and she comes back into the car, and then there's this little boy sitting in there with her child, and Jesus. She looks over and sees the kid with black eyes. And she asks, "Why is this kid in here?" And her child says, "Well, because I invited him in, Mom." And then like the kid disappears, and so she looks around for him. And so and then on the way home, she gets into some kind of like car accident or something like that, or like her husband is going to meet her some. No, that's right. She calls her husband. And she cannot leave she's too freaked out to leave. She calls him to come get her, and he ends up having an accident on the way over there, hurts himself really bad. And then the kid, their little kid, gets sick. And yeah, I think Weatherly talks about that in the book.
That's like, what I'm saying. You don't hear the stories where they invite him in.
Yeah. But that's one where they did get invited in, just not by the person that. Yeah, there's there's this whole sickness aspect to them, and then you know
it is very vampiric, the invitation.
Yeah, and David Jacobs, you know, Nick Redfern drew a kind of a parallel between the stuff that David Jacobs writes about the alien human hybrids and how they're supposedly trying to infiltrate humanity. And some of this stuff in there is very similar to what people report the black-eyed kids doing, like wearing the outdated clothing, speaking in a very kind of archaic way. Yeah.
Yeah. I've forwarded some information to Nick. I don't know if he's done anything. I don't think he's done anything with it yet, but man, that guy's the most prolific writer age.
Yeah.
But I forwarded him some stuff that when I was, and this is the one reason other than making my wife mad that I decided not to pursue a book, because I got contacted by a guy who called himself Dracos. Okay, whatever, guy. And then he started telling me that, you know, I'm a black-eyed person. I'm an adult. I'm a black-eyed person. And there are other black-eyed people. We can look exactly like you. We live among you. We are just waiting for the dragon to come into the world. I'm like, the dragon? He said, Satan. I'm like, oh, okay. And then he went on to explain to me that the black-eyed kids are – he said, your people are descendants of Adam and Eve. My people are descendants of the serpent. Okay. I am not talking to you anymore.
Wow.
But again, I sent all my emails that I got and my transcripts and my phone conversations with him. And hopefully Nick does something on it and survives.
He's a tough guy.
He's a tough guy.
Well, I think maybe the story that I kind of want to end on, that I want to end on here is a story where the black-eyed kid did not achieve his final form. And that is the giant cockroach story. This by far is the most bizarre story in the book.
Yeah, and this lady was so serious about this. She was traveling from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. This was back in the 1990s. And she stopped in a small town at a motel for the night. And she was sitting in her room watching VH1, and there was a knock on the door. And she went to the door, and she pulled it open. She had the chain on, so she pulled it open just a little bit. And there was a voice that said, ask, would you like some – would you like some new bed linen? And she couldn't really see who was in the hallway because it was dark. And then all of a sudden it kind of turned, it shifted its body a little bit, and the light that was behind it now went on its face, and it was a cockroach. It was a 6-foot-tall cockroach. And she said it had turned its head because you know how bugs do that cleaning its front legs thing? It was rubbing its legs together. And she screamed and slammed the door.
It was a salesman?
Huh?
It was a salesman cockroach?
Yes, it was a salesman cockroach. He had vacuum cleaners. But she screamed and the thing was asking her why she was screaming from the other side of the door. And she couldn't, she didn't have a door to the outside. So what she did, and she literally told me that I remembered watching a Chuck Norris movie. Excellent. So she threw the door open, fell down, and kicked its legs out from under it. And when she got up and jumped over it and ran down the hallway, and
was it laying there wiggling with its arm with its legs in the air?
she didn't say because she didn't look back.
It was Gregor Samsa, you know.
Yeah, but she started running and she saw a hotel employee laying on the ground unconscious. Didn't know if this person was dead or not. And she was running, and all of a sudden she heard the thundering of this huge insect running behind her. And she got to the door, and the thing grabbed her. It grabbed her wrist. And, the insects, the leg was all jagged and it hurt. And she had just gotten to the door, and she was able to get the door open and slam it, and pinched one of its antenna off. Oh. And she kicked it; it released her at that point, and she started running out into the parking lot. And fortunately, there was a cop across the street. And when she was telling the cop what happened, he was like, "Uh huh, yes." Okay. And she turned around and looked, and she said her and the cop both saw that cockroach and about three others run over a hill and disappear.
What in the hell? It kind of reminds me a little bit of that X-Files episode, where the guy's working in the call center and he's got the,
There's that he thinks his boss is a giant cockroach that's trying to eat people. Do you remember that one?
I remember that.
I'm trying to think. The only one with bugs is the one with Mulder was hitting. He got drunk and hit on the blonde girl.
Well, this is like this guy like holds everybody hostage in this call center because he thinks that his boss is a large cockroach and he's draining the life out of him. So like some of the other workers are just zombies that do its bidding. And then Mulder actually sees that it actually is a giant cockroach, and he starts going nuts.
I've seen every episode of the X-Files. I can't believe I can't remember that one.
I think it was maybe in the seventh season, sixth or seventh season, something like that.
Sounds great.
In other words, he's just sucking the life out of his employees as a giant cockroach.
You know, that's just corporate America.
Yeah, man, that's capitalism. Much. What are you going to do?
Well, Jason, thank you so much. I mean, this has been awesome to finally talk to you. What's next for you, and where can people get this book, American Monsters?
Well, you can get it from my website. It's jasonoffutt.com. That's jasonoffutt.com. I've got links to all my books on my website, or you can go to my publisher, Llewellyn Worldwide. Llewellyn Worldwide, or just Amazon. Everything I've written is on Amazon. I've got four more books on the paranormal and a few humor books, a couple zombie novels. So fun.
Nice. Are you writing anything else now? Are you another book coming out?
I'm working on Chasing Canada's Monsters.
Okay.
Right now, I've kind of put that in the back burner for right now because a novel that I wrote in the fall is under one of the last revisions. So I need to get that out to a publisher pretty soon.
Okay. Well, excellent. Guys, is there anything that you wanted to add? Or?
Thanks for coming on. This has been a blast for me. I love these kind of episodes personally. I'm really big into the cryptozoology stuff, and the more bizarre out there ones, the better. So this has just been a delight for me.
Yeah, that was cool. We kind of went on a crypto tour there of the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love monsters.
Who doesn't? Giant cockroaches and all. All right. Well, stay on the line for us, Jason. We're going to close out this section, and we'll be back to close out the show on Conspiranormal. Bring us in, Rob. Bring us back.
That was awesome. Giant cockroaches and dog man and black-eyed kids and everything.
So you never heard of the Michigan merman?
No.
Or merfolk?
I haven't. Now I got to watch all these YouTube videos.
Don't assume it's gender, Adam.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Merpeople.
Merpeople. Thank you. Merpeople. They. You saw a pill of those videos. I don't know, man. Some of those videos don't look too... I don't know if those are real. I'm just going to put that to you.
I haven't watched them yet. Don't spoil it.
All right. You're going to go hunt. Next time you go visit your mom and dad, you're going to say, hey, let's go hunt the Michigan mer people?
Oh, hell yeah.
Catch and release them.
Catch and release.
No, catch and profit. I'm stuffing that thing.
Serfiel, anything? We were talking about the Giants. You kind of started shaking your head a little bit. I know we've been kind of getting into this.
Oh yeah, it's been in Tennessee too, and the red hair is usually from oxidization.
Yeah. What we were talking about? Like, do you think that's part of the whole? What is it? You've been studying about the
antiquarianism.
Yeah,
it was
kind of like a pseudo archaeology.
Yeah, and then there were some like mummies that were kind of fabricated, and I don't know. You know, it was profitable to have something like that. You could put it on display,
right,
and charge. You know. everyone to come look at it. So I guess this Kentucky, there was a Kentucky mummy that really started the craze, and then everyone started trying to find giants and pygmies. And
yeah.
So yeah, a little skeptical of that, but the other stuff that's more weird and maybe non-physical is I find more interesting.
Yes, I agree. I don't know that I buy into any kind of breeding population of any kind of creature that could be out there. For me, it's more likely either genetic memory or folklore mixed with genetic memory or some kind of mass hysteria or just a combination of all of those things.
Because
we did used to live, it was only 10, 15,000 years ago, we did live alongside lots of other different hominids. We were fighting for our survival. We were trying to outdo them as far as, you know, survival goes. So especially any of the upright hominid, dogman even could fit into that kind of thing. Bigfoot definitely.
You know what I was thinking about? I saw a video of a bear walking around on its hind legs because it
I've seen a couple of those.
It had an injury on its front. Yeah. So, like, would a dog try to walk around like that if, like, they had an injured front leg?
I can't remember what it was. It was the big story. It was in France. It was a dog-like creature. You know what I'm talking about? Back in the day, I can't remember.
Are you talking about the Beast of Gavadon?
Maybe.
Is it was it in the 18th century?
Yes.
That might be what you're
talking about. It was very popular at the time to have exotic pets as well.
Yes.
So a lot of the theories are that it was either it wasn't a dog, it was either a hyena, or what more fits the description of a dog-like face but with more human-like characteristics is a baboon. People then didn't know what a baboon was.
Yeah, if you don't know what that is, you
see a baboon, you think, it's like a little werewolf person.
Yeah.
You know, like, seriously, look at one.
Because you got the long snout.
Yeah. It's got all that. Right. And I mean, that could happen here too. Exotic pets were big here too in the 1800s.
Yeah. Well, that would, you know, say that there's a population somehow that's out there that's still
most extant. Of those sightings were
50
to 100 years ago. I'm not saying there's a breeding population, but it could have been a loose baboon or two just running around. Same thing with the skunk ape. There's been orangutans caught on trail cams in Florida.
I've seen that. Yeah, I've seen the picture of that. Yeah.
I mean,
that's entirely possible.
An orangutan living out in the wilderness in Florida.
If somebody had an exotic pet.
If you came across an orangutan in Florida.
Or some kind of illegal trade in this animal.
It smells like crap. Yeah. You're going to call it a skunk ape. You know?
Right.
Yeah, it's covered in moss.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's all wet and gross. And
like swamp thing.
See, I don't doubt that there could be this population maybe these small populations of these animals that could be out there. It's when you get to the weirder material that you say there's more going on here.
Or the unique cases, the very unique cases. Yeah, like that's obviously not that's not a species. That's not something that fits into the normal tree of life, you know.
So I went to Expedition Bigfoot.
Oh, how was that?
Over this weekend, last weekend, which was all part of.
I'm pretending to be like I don't know. You brought me a t-shirt.
Yes, though. I bought you a shirt. Seraphiel has a shirt as well. So this was all part of the Paramania festivities, which is something that's done every year. They call it an unconference. And I was there with Joshua Cutchin, who this year was hosting it, and Greg Bishop was around, Tim Banal, a few other people that I got to meet that were some really cool, interesting people. So we went on Saturday. We were at Expedition Bigfoot in Blue Ridge, Georgia, which was an interesting little place. Just this museum totally dedicated to Bigfoot. You would have loved it, Rob.
Is it like the old guy from Harry and the Hendersons? Remember his little shop?
No.
Where he's like, you want Bigfoot hair? I get you Bigfoot hair all day.
Yeah, this was much larger. They did, as I mentioned before, have Bigfoot shit. It was extremely long. There were some original casts that were there. Dan Maslach actually came and met me up there. And we talked. He told us some interesting stories. I want to get Dan back on the show to talk about some of that, because some of the stuff he told me was really, really interesting. We actually did some of the presentations over there. So, like, Greg went up and gave a presentation. Josh Wren was also there at Paramania too. And Josh did his presentation about Where Do the Footprints End, which is going to be the title of his and Timothy Renner's new book.
Nice.
So
they're almost done with that, aren't they?
I think they're shooting for the fall. And Josh isn't sure whether it's going to be a single book or two, because there's just a lot in it. And I really think that this book is going to put together a lot of pieces that it's going to make a lot of cryptozoologists mad, because they're really challenging the physical Bigfoot paradigm.
Where does the poop come from?
Where does the poop come from?
It's like that cosmic alchemy we always talk about.
Uh-huh. That's it. That's it. That's it. Yep. So we did that. And Josh actually got a resounding approval from the owner of Expedition Bigfoot when he went up there. And I thought at first he was going to lay into Josh for saying that it was not physically real, because a lot of what Josh talked about was how the Bigfoot and poltergeists can be similar, like this, some of the phenomenon. He actually said that there's so much more going on. He said there in Blue Ridge, in that area, this is in North Georgia, that he has had so many people tell him that they have seen Bigfoot and had weird experiences revolving around it. And so there's much more going on to that phenomenon. And I think, you know, too, with that is the Bigfoot stuff is so popular now. Like, I don't know when that started becoming so popular.
TV.
And now more and more people are seeing it. So it's like, is it the fact that now people are more willing to come out and say, yeah, I've seen it? Or is it this same kind of tulpa effect that we just talked about, where now it's in the culture, it's in people's minds, and so now people start to see it. And it manifests.
I tend to lean more that way.
I do too.
I mean, there's not enough physical evidence to justify a physical thing.
Yeah, there's Dogman is even more, I think, impossible.
A ton of eyewitness stuff, a ton of really believable stories, people that seem very sincere. You know, I mean, that stuff is just, there's just thousands and thousands of cases, but
well, I mean, someone would have had to have shot one. That's the whole argument, you know. Someone would have shot one, but then again, I guess there's people who think that there's a massive cover-up.
Yeah, or one piece of hair that has DNA evidence. That's all it would take.
Right. Exactly. We also, on Saturday night when we got back, we all hung out in the lobby of the La Quinta Inn in Alpharetta, Georgia. Got pretty drunk. And then we went upstairs to Wren's room and we did a angel summoning ritual, which was extremely interesting experience. So Wren took a piece of paper and wrote this sigil with all, like, the angels' names on it. I guess there's seven angels. And you're supposed to ask a request for the angel to help you with something. And so, actually, Greg Bishop actually asked for a request for help with something. And so he was kind of the center of it, while Wren gave would you call it an incantation? I mean, what would you call it?
Enochian, isn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of like Enochian language. I think there was some Latin in there. But, well, you know, Wren's based in OTO. He's based in the Thelema stuff. And this is the first time that I've done anything like this. So I was a little trepidatious about it. Of course, I was a little drunk too, so I really didn't really care.
You were trepidatious the next day.
Yeah, but actually, I'm going to get to that, because when we first started doing it, all of a sudden the rain, it starts raining and like thundering and lightning as we're doing it. And I have to imagine what the fuck the, sorry, what the people in the next room. Yeah. Don't worry. You don't have to bleep that out.
I like bleeping stuff out.
You know, so the people in the next room were thinking at like 2:30 in the morning when you're hearing like Wren chanting and it's like thundering. It's storming. They were probably freaking their shit. So, okay, so we get all in this circle, and Wren says some things in whatever the language that is, and we all have to, you know, make these circles.
Like that scene in the first Child's Play where he's trying to, like, take over the kid's body, and the storm clouds are gathering above the tower.
I guess it was something like that.
That's what I'm picturing.
You all had to trace the circle?
No, no. He had the circle. He had a piece. He had, like, a... like a bowl on the circle, and you had to give an offering, which we had, I think, some George Dickel left over.
Hell yeah.
So you poured some George Dickel into the offering, and we were calling on the angel Gabriel. And as we're doing this,
you gave him George Dickel?
Yeah. Well, that's all we had available, okay? So we're
sorry, I'm a whiskey
snob. We stop, we rotate, Wren says some more stuff, we stop, we rotate. And the whole time I'm watching Josh, and he's like at this point drunk, and he's just like swaying. And Tim Bernal is like nudging me. He's just like pointing at him. So, you know, like we're really thinking at any time he's just going to like fall over the table and break this circle. And so we do this, you know, so Greg is still the center of it because he's the one asking the question for the help. And then, it ends, and he basically does this like binding thing that kind of like tells the angel to go, essentially, and that was it. And from my perspective, I don't know what everybody else felt, but from my perspective, you could feel like this certain kind of power in the room that was very palpable, but I can't really say that there was like a presence there. Sure. I could almost feel just like it was our collective, like the 9 or 10 of us our collective energy as a group was producing that. Yeah.
That's why
it was psychological in some ways.
That's why I lean more towards the whole chaos magic thing. The older I get is because I think that there's definitely a power in ritual and there's a power in belief, but I don't think that power necessarily exists in any one particular realm of like a belief system. You know, I think that it's all inherent in us to begin with, and just getting people together. I don't think the ritual itself matters, other than it's the more you put into it and the more believable it is, more energy everybody kind of donates to it, the more power it has.
Yeah.
You know, language aside, words aside,
that's how it crystals,
whatever,
me.
None of the, all of that stuff aside, like, I think that all of that stuff is just a focus for that energy.
Yeah. That's how it felt to me too. But two things that I felt about it that, like, oddly enough to me, like the chanting and all that kind of stuff, it kind of puts you in this trance. And I've had that same kind of experience at like a Greek Orthodox church ceremony. Mm-hmm. It felt very similar. It gets you into that. It kind of gets you into this kind of trance-like state almost. And when it was done for me, like I felt energized. Like it energized me, you know? And
you were the focus of
No, I wasn't the focus. Okay. I wasn't even the focus. I was just part of it.
Okay.
And it was, you know, well, Greg was the one supplicating, I guess, right, or asking the question of the angel. But I felt like, oh man, it's just like, wow. I mean, it was an interesting feeling. And this was after a long day. It's about 2:30 in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. And I felt like, wow, I mean, this is, you know, so it was interesting. I never would have said 6-7 years ago that I would be doing an occult ritual, but I was a part of it.
Do you know what Greg asked for? I'm not asking you to share it. I'm just wondering.
Oh, I'll tell you. I'll tell you later.
Okay.
Yeah. I know what he asked for, but yeah, that's kind of personal to him. So
yeah, I figured it was.
Yeah.
What were some of the other reactions from the other guys?
I think a couple of them felt like, well, you know, it's interesting. I think a couple of them were kind of, one or two of them were moved by it. You had different varying kind of reactions between each, from person to person. Some may didn't even know what they were getting into, you know. So, I mean, it was pretty fascinating. It was a good time.
Cool.
It's a good time. And hopefully going to be going back to Paramania next year, but there may be some interesting things happening with that possibly. So, cool. All right. Well, that's it. Rob, we tell everybody about Patreon. I'm thinking we'll have a Patreon episode up by the time this airs. So
nice. If you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/conspiranormal. There's different tiers on there. We've got lots of bonus episodes, tons of them at this point. It's always growing. We're always adding more to it. You can subscribe to the different tiers. We've got various things going on there. If you don't want to subscribe to anything, but you want to help the show, you can do a one-time donation on our website at www.conspiranormal.com, which is back up and running. And if you want to help the show, but you don't want to spend money doing a nice 5-star review or just sharing us with your friends or even just email, you know, or Facebook comments. We love all that stuff. So
yeah, definitely leave the iTunes comments. We've gotten few and far between lately. So, all right, guys, thank you so much. We're going to be back next time with another guest. We'll be back in Studio B, but, you know, the quality will still be the same.
That's right, because Surfail's a badass.
All right, guys, join us next time on Conspiranormal! Nokian Magic.
That becomes nothing.